Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
What do you do when you have a loved one who struggles with mental health or addiction issues? What I can recommend to you is you give us a call at Cash Centers. We're in network with most insurance providers. We're also out of network with a bunch of insurance providers. And even if your loved one or you is not appropriate for us, we will make a recommendation in your local city or hometown with the extensive resources that we have. So go to castcenters.com. That's castcenters.com. Check us out, give us a call, and we'll help you find the right resources. Back at Always Evolving, and I have Dr. Mel Pohl with me. Dr. Mel, thanks for sitting down with me.
Yeah, it's great to be here in the rain.
In the rain. We're in the rain right now. And, you know, you are a pain management specialist, you would say.
Truly, I work with people with chronic pain. My background is I'm a family practice physician and an addiction specialist. And I got interested in pain because so many people in the day who were on opioids were getting prescription opioids for pain. And they'd say, what are you going to do about my pain after they were detoxed? And I'd say, I don't know.
You know, right.
Go back to your pain doctor, which is a pretty piddling answer. So I got real interested in pain about 15 years ago. And that's become my area of interest.
Have you seen that a lot more people are getting addicted to pain pills than before?
Well, you know, there's been a shift. Certainly 10, 15 years ago, everybody was getting lots and lots of pain pills because that was sort of the way of treatment. And then, of course, the overdose epidemic really took full hold and the government got involved. The CDC came out with guidelines. So there's been a shift away from easy prescribing, but there's still, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of people who are dependent on opioids and they got on them because of pain.
Yeah. You know, I'm a recovering addict and I've
heard.
You've heard? are you, you don't say you are. Okay.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. No, and I'm happy to say it.
You know, one thing that we see a lot is that a lot of relapses are not coming from going to the bar.
Yeah.
That a lot of relapses are coming from seeing a doctor and being prescribed something that then triggers that obsession to use and creates the illusion that it's the answer.
It's all kosher because it's doctor prescribed.
Yeah. And then what happens is it becomes so difficult for people in recovery to come back after a relapse.
Yes.
Because part of what recovery programs do, you know, you get a chip for 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, 1 year. And for a lot of recovering addicts, they carry around that badge of sobriety as a big self-esteem boost. It's like, okay, it was a shitty day, but I didn't use today.
Right.
And so I've known a lot of people who have had 10 plus years and they never come back.
Yeah. Because of the shame and the...
Yeah,
it's a real conundrum because, I mean, I go to meetings on a regular basis and I can't tell you how many people talk about their medications and they say, but it's medications prescribed by a doctor. And in my head, I'm saying, oh, dude, you know, that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, you need to be in the hands of a doctor who understands addiction, who understands dependence, who understands the potential, which most doctors don't, that if I take an opioid and I'm an alcoholic, it can potentially trigger my brain in a way that I'm going to either want the opioids more or I'm going to relapse to alcohol or God knows what. And,
and
as you say, both happen and it's real sad. I mean, and I've treated a lot of people like that. And the interesting discussion is, do I reset my sobriety date? Because after all, I haven't had a drink.
Right.
And of course, I, you know, in my opinion and what I tell them is you set your sobriety date. The only one who cares is you.
Yeah.
And maybe your sponsor. You know, do what's in your heart as long as you're being honest with yourself. And there are a lot of people, Mike, who take these meds as prescribed. They're not getting high on them. They're not, you know, chewing them necessarily. They're not using illicit substances. They're getting a prescription and taking it to help relieve the pain. And, you know, they become often, they become dependent, often they become lost. And what I say is, you know, addiction, one of the best definitions is it's the pathological pursuit of reward, which I know well, or relief. And for these people, it's pathological pursuit of relief, and they do it in the face of all the dysfunctions that happen as a result of use. But it's not the same as, you know, drinking alcoholically.
Yeah, it's clean time's a really interesting thing, right? Because I think a lot of people don't come back after relapses because of the shame and because of seeing their friends. Wow, the rain's really pouring.
Oh, it's pouring.
I mean, Sophia, can you hear the rain through there?
It's crazy.
So you guys listening, that's the rain in California.
In Los Angeles.
West Hollywood.
Well, it's an atmospheric river, whatever the hell that is.
Right, right.
I never heard of such a thing.
It is pouring.
Yeah.
It's interesting because the recovery support system of 12 steps or recovery means and such is the same. However, the traditions, like, they haven't been mended at all.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the traditions is like anonymity, right? Mm-hmm. But meetings aren't necessarily that anonymous anymore. It's almost like, on one hand, the stigma went away, which is good.
Which is a good thing.
But on the other hand, it's not what it used to be, right?
Well, I mean, I'm not a student of the steps but or the traditions, but I, as I understand it, anonymity is about humility. It's,
right.
it's, you know, not having my name associated with recovery because I'm a human and I'm an individual. And, you know, on the other hand, there's no, that's six hands by now, but, you know, to have a celebrity endorse recovery is impactful for people who are reluctant to get involved. Right.
Yeah.
So,
cause I was even, I went to a meeting last night and I shared, and then I realized that there were a few people who were previous clients from CAST at the meeting.
Oh yeah.
And so immediately when I saw, all of a sudden, my filter completely changed,
of
right?
Of course, of course.
Where I didn't dig in and get as vulnerable as
and
as I could be just out of fear that I'm not the perfect CEO. And, you know, it's like a weird.
Yeah, I got it. No, I totally get it.
It's so strange because, and a lot of them don't get it.
Because of that, or because of
like whatever, or
how do you get humble when
I mean, because the reality is, you got to work for recovery. Yeah. There's no shortcut. You know, everyone wants to take these shortcuts. They want to go on a mushroom trip, or you know, and go do ayahuasca, or they want to like go somewhere.
That's a little psilocybin. I mean, you know, come on.
Yeah. Like that's going to resolve my spiritual bankruptcy, right?
Yeah, I mean, psychic change coming from a mushroom
literally
farm. Yeah, it's that's a. An area of grave concern for me because, look, we're addicts and we'd love to have a easier, softer way, you know, doctor prescribed.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it's the same issue that we've been talking about with opioids, but these psychedelics, they're disorganizing to brains. And, you know, as you know, we see so many co-occurring mental illness and substance use, and you put a dissociative anesthetic or a hallucinogen into those brains,
right.
Especially unsupervised. I really fear for the well-being of, you know, the community, because the message is, oh, this is it. You know, there's science behind it. And the Journal of American Medical Association just wrote an article about how great psychedelics are.
I know. Yeah. It's interesting. Sophia, do you need us to talk up because of the rain or no? That's good. Yeah, no, it's interesting in general, the promotion of solutions for mental health, addiction. You know, like I found myself getting slightly annoyed with all the virtual ads for virtual therapy online.
Sure.
I mean, on television, right? So basically a company that has the most money can afford to run ads, whereas like a great primary therapist could never afford to be, you know, paying a celebrity to endorse therapy. Now, the problem is, we all know that depending on your disorder, it's really helpful to get a specialist.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're helping someone, we found at least like our patients that showed up had twice as likelihood of staying sober as our clients who were in the online programs.
Interesting. Because the data, I don't think, says that. You know, there's some, I've seen a study where virtual treatment is as good.
I don't believe it.
It's hard for me
to believe
it.
I really believe it's being manipulated by
evidence, you know, anything that's real is claims to be evidence-based.
Right.
Beware.
Yeah, you have to be wary because you're like, who funded this
that's right.
evidence in this research?
That's right.
And the reality is it doesn't make logical sense. And I believe, I mean, I'm on a tangent today. I believe therapists have gotten lazy. And I believe they've gotten lazy because they got through COVID.
Yeah.
They got the benefits of working from home and managing their own schedule. Yeah, you know. They want to charge the same amount of money.
Right.
Because they don't have to, but for the patient, get them out of the house.
Yeah.
Give them a hug.
Yeah. I mean,
hold them when they're like, you know, going through something. Show it can't it just logically, I'm baffled lately by like this, the mental health industry becoming, in my opinion, not always so about the patient.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we all have mixed motivations, right?
Yeah.
I mean, money's one, comfort's one.
Sure.
I mean, I talk to lots of friends who are therapists and they say, well, I don't have to leave the house. Save an hour.
Right. You know? That it's about them.
And the patient likes it too, you know?
I'm sure. Yeah, but.
Because they don't have to leave the house.
They don't have to leave
now,
the house.
If they're agoraphobic, probably not. It'd be good if they got out.
Right. Or I can't imagine working with someone with an eating disorder, you know, and like having to do body work or, you know, I know therapists now are doing like EMDR virtually. And I'm like, is there any study about, it's just like COVID made it. So everyone's like, this is convenient for me.
It really is. I totally agree. And I mean, I utilize virtual because I see patients both in person and virtually, but you're right. It is so much better
to be in the room
with somebody and touch them and
You
know, being able to, there's a different connection than on a screen.
Yeah. And virtual has existed for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So virtual sessions was never a new concept.
Sure.
For certain
types
of like maintenance.
Yeah.
Checkups.
Yeah.
But like therapeutic sessions, it just seems a little weird to me that I talked to therapy. My practice is so busy and I'm just doing it.
And I don't go anywhere. I'm in my pajamas all day.
Yeah. And then on top of that, they're not paying for office space anymore.
Right.
But they're keeping the same. I would love it too.
It's a good deal. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great deal.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if I'm resentful, bitter, annoyed, or just judgmental or all of them.
Well,
there's something about it though that bothers me lately.
I understand. I mean, it's so prevalent and it has been normalized. So I get it.
Yeah,
I really do. And I think
because I think with pain management, for example, mm-hmm. it is such a niche of what to treat. Yes. Right. You have to understand a lot of elements of the pain, what's real, what's drug seeking, what's not, what's the real medical issue.
Yes and no. I mean, I have my philosophy. We don't call it pain management. We call it pain recovery.
Cool.
Because pain management is medicate or inject or operate. That's the medical system's response to chronic pain, all three of which are really inadequate.
Yeah.
The first premise about chronic pain is that all pain is real. So we never question anybody's report of pain. They have experienced a decade or more of being misunderstood and mistrusted by their physician, by their family. Yeah, because so what happens is somebody has a pain condition, let's say it's a back pain, and they enter the medical system. So the medical system is all about diagnosing and treating. So what's the diagnosis? Well, you test them and then you do an MRI and then you do a CAT scan and then you do a MRI with contrast and that didn't show. So then we do an epidural where, you know, you inject the spine with steroids and that gives you very little relief, less than 10% benefit. Costs about a couple 3,000.
Wow.
Come back for a second one. And then the doc does a radiofrequency ablation, which is burning the nerve. And eventually, if none of that works, they say, well, you have a stenosis here. You have a disc pressing. We're going to go in and operate on it. And what we'll do is we'll stabilize your spine with titanium rods so you can't bend more than 5 degrees and you won't have any pain anymore.
Mm.
That works less than 25% of the time. So the patient comes back after all of this, no better, maybe worse. And the doctor says, I don't know what's wrong with you. I fixed your back. You should be better. And then what's the implication is you must be making it up.
Right.
That's a disservice to the patient. Mm. It's a disconnect between the efficacious therapist, the most important thing that a therapist, whether it's a physician or a psychotherapist or a counselor, can do is connect. Just what we were saying, you know, in person better than online. And if you come in and you don't believe your patient, you immediately discount the ability to connect with that patient. Mm. So for the people who are listening who are therapists, start with the premise that the pain is real. Now, the second part of the equation is that the pain is real and it doesn't exist nearly as much in the body as it does in the brain. And it's the brain, thoughts and feelings, essentially, the sensation of safety that's diminished. Usually trauma survivors, 95% of our patients at the point who have chronic pain have serious trauma. And, you know, they come to their life with some either ACE-related inadequacy, you know, they had terrible childhood or they had this terrible trauma. And now they're in this condition, which is demeaning and it's anxiety provoking and it's fear inducing and they're angry and they're frustrated and they're depressed. And that is chronic pain.
Right.
You know, maybe the disc is what started it. Maybe an accident is what started it. But the reality is they've got a miscommunication from the brain to the body. And the brain believes, they're not making it up, they believe that this is what's happening in their body. And there's a circuit that develops over the course of time so that it's really enhanced over time. It's reinforced. You know, I move this way and it hurts. Oh, it must mean that my disc is out of place. No, you just had a fight with your husband, you know. That's where we start is, you know, show up, get present and get safe. Because people invariably, partly because of the medical system, partly because of family misunderstanding, if drugs are involved, it complicates matters. You know, don't get me wrong. But drug seeking for a pain patient who has addiction is like saying somebody who has prostate problems is potty seeking. You know, I have to pee because my prostate's enlarged. You know, it's a condition. Well, people look for their relief pathologically because they're in so much distress.
But isn't there a point and where, like, so for example, from my understanding, if I was addicted to opioids, so I had disc replacement in my neck about 4 years ago.
You want to complain about it now?
No complaints. I have a jiu-jitsu tournament this weekend, actually, in Orlando.
You're an active guy.
So. I'm going to try to be an active guy. I'm like, you go, Mike. You don't stop. But let's say I started taking pain pills, and it numbed out the pain. At the point I start to decrease the pain pills, isn't it such that like the opposite effect is just naturally going to come back?
So, yeah. I mean, if we introduce opioids, you know, if it's a broken bone, opioid short term and off makes good sense. That's acute pain. For chronic pain, you know, 3 to 6 months or more that is not likely to end, opioids is not a good solution. Mm. You know, they told us they were. They had studies, they had evidence that claimed that not only could you take opioids, you could take as much as you wanted. You could go as high as you wanted because you didn't become tolerant. All lies. Mm. And it was promoted, you know, this is the big lawsuits with Purdue Pharma. I mean, it was absolute bogus misrepresentation of information. But the message came, take opioids, take more opioids. If you're not getting relief, take more opioids. And then add a long-acting to a short-acting and be on them the rest of your life. And what happens in people who are on chronic opioids is kind of what you were implying. First of all, we become tolerant. So the opioid doesn't work as good. Mm. So the only thing to do at that point is to be in more pain or to increase the dose.
Right.
And the doctor thinks increase the dose. At least it's better, but we used to think that. There's another weird thing, which is that there's a phenomenon called opiate-induced hyperalgesia. So opioids, when you take them chronically, they cause an inflammation in the brain.
Mm.
They cause more pain. And we've got studies on this.
Mm.
So taking opioids and increasing the dose is just a bad idea. And then lastly, as you said, if you take opioids and then you stop them, you're in withdrawal. Well, and withdrawal is pain. So
right.
Every time you're in between doses, if you're tolerant, you're essentially in withdrawal. So the life of somebody who's opioid dependent, who's taking them for pain, is more pain. That's the only way. There are some people that take low dose opioids forever, no big deal. They don't have addiction. But we're talking about, you know, this group of folks who have become dependent and who have increased the dose in an attempt to get to be pain-free, and it's become pathological.
What is the best thing to say to someone that you're friends with, or, you know, our parents, as they get older, they end up in pain, to be supportive, but also not engage in a conversation every single time? Like,
well, no, that's, yeah.
Right? Like, what's a good strategy for talking to someone who has chronic pain?
So at the point, we don't use the word pain very much.
That's right, recovery.
But the word pain, you know, what's your pain score? We ask people, what's their bananas like today? So that it's really sort of a diffusion of the focus on the pain, because you look at pain, pain increases. You know, whatever you attend to, just from a brain function, the more attention you pay to the pain, the more pain you'll have. So, and there's a basis for that. You know, you're distracted, you don't feel your pain. Even if you're in pain, you get engaged in an interesting conversation. The pain is irrelevant. Well, how does that happen? It happens because your brain's equipped to suppress pain when you don't need it. If you think you need it, if you're convinced that I need that pain to protect me, then it will promote more pain. You don't need that pain to protect you. I mean, your disc probably didn't do, I don't know about your, but I mean, most of the patients I see with degenerative disc disease, that's like wrinkles. It just happens as you get older. You know, the spine isn't as intact as it used to be. And it's no big deal. But if you get fixated on the idea that that degenerative, I had a patient who said to me, "Doctor, my spine is degenerating. It's crumbling. Like right now, I can feel it. I can rubs again." Well, that's all bullshit. But that's the belief. Right. And it's not made up. They've been told that. They've been fed that information. So a lot of pain recovery is unraveling that false story, if you will.
Yeah. How much of pain recovery, would it be pain recovery? Is that
the right? That's it.
Would be about the real physical ailment that exists versus emotional.
20%
is physical. So I find for myself, like, heartbreak is like the most painful thing.
Right. And it, just by the way, it lives in the same part of the brain as disc disease.
Right. I know. It's interesting what rejection does.
Disappointment.
Yeah. Like
anger, you know, not getting what you want. All the stuff that we learn how to deal with.
And what I find is I try to desperately figure out a way to not feel what I'm feeling. Because at a certain point, I'm like, okay, I'm sitting in the feeling. I feel this way.
Yes.
I don't want to keep feeling this way. And the mind then tries to figure out a way.
Yes.
Without, let's say, using, you know, medication.
Yes.
To shift.
Yes.
What solutions do you have?
So, one of the things, there's a guy in town, Alan Gordon. He works at the Pain Psychology Center.
Okay.
It's a cool place. They do outpatient treatment in conjunction, same philosophy as what we do. And they do a thing called pain reprocessing therapy. But the essence of what he says is, if you're looking to be pain-free, whether it's heartbreak or back pain, if you apply the energy that you would apply to jujitsu, you will be an utter failure
A
failure. You will not be able to successfully eliminate your pain by gritting your teeth and squeezing your fists. The way to deal with that pain is to open your hands and take a breath and allow whatever's there to be there for as long as it's there. And when we stop fighting, what we resist persists is a psychological expression. With people with chronic pain, a lot of the work is, again, allowing the nervous system to find safety, because when we're on alert, we don't get better.
So what type of stuff, when you're in pain and you are, whether it's physical pain, emotional pain, whatever it is.
The point has been made. It's the same, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And you're aware and you're alone, right? It's, while in pain, it's quite difficult to go, I'm quite curious. Like, now, sure, if we're in a group, it could be a little bit easier. But when you're alone and you're feeling it, at least, I guess perhaps the first step that I'm realizing is, if I'm in pain, I need to immediately, I mean, I never like this word grace, but I have to have grace for myself.
Yeah.
Or someone else has to. And to realize this isn't a lack of growing.
Right.
This is the opportunity to grow.
This is growing.
Yeah.
You're doing it, you know.
Because it can feel the same, right?
So, yeah.
That's what's so confusing.
Well, with growth, what I explain to people, including myself, is that it's sort of like a spiral. So if you're going around a spiral and you're moving in an upward direction, every once in a while on the curve, you're in exactly the same spot, but you're really not in the same. You're in the same spot, but you're on a different trajectory. So if you just sort of hang in there, you'll see, oh no, you're 20 years sober and you have a whole different approach. There are similarities because you didn't get a brain transplant.
Right.
You know, you still got those circuits, and trauma circuits are highly entrenched in our cells, you know, in our, not irreversibly, but highly entrenched. And what they actually showed in this study of the people that did pain reprocessing therapy is their brains changed. They did functional MRI scans of people's pain responses, and they showed a change in the relationship between the part of the brain that alerts. So the insula, which is, says, uh-oh, something's wrong, became less connected to the prefrontal cortex, which is the thought sort of conclusion part of the brain. They actually measured changes and showed changes in glucose uptake in the brain after 6 weeks of therapy. So,
and what type of therapy is it?
There's five parts to pain reprocessing therapy. The first is education, that this is as much or more emotional as it is physical. Very hard. That's probably the hardest part. People get stuck there because, like, no, it's, you know, I had a patient who said, are you telling me my pain is in my head? And I said, well, you have headaches. So, like, where else do you think your pain is, right? You know,
right.
But it was like as if it was not real. And it is real. So the pain is real, but the emotions and thoughts drive it. So that's the educational part. The second part is getting data. So the Sherlock Holmes, you know, examining the facts. It hurts after I have a terrible conversation with, or I break up with somebody and my back hurts, you know. Uh-huh. Oh, so there's an association. I can sit through a ball game and I'm fine. But when I, you know, I'm sitting through a conversation with my work partner, I'm excruciating pain. Oh, that's interesting. So, you know, and in your case, it would be what's the emotional stuff that comes up. The third part is called somatic tracking. And it's a meditative process where, and the cool part about that is that they say it's outcome independent. So it's not to get rid of the pain. It's simply to notice the pain, to track it, to make sure you understand that you're not in any danger, you know, to allow yourself to see it, to allow yourself to believe it. The fourth component is identifying other issues like fear, anxiety, anger, depression, you know, other psychological, psychiatric illness. And the fifth is finding joy. So, you know, connecting with something positive that, you know, drives well-being.
So a lot of people will say whenever you're in pain, you should distract yourself.
If it works, that's great.
Got it.
You know,
but you've heard that, I'm sure.
And it works. Yeah. And it works because there's a part of the brain when we are distracted, it's called the periaqueductal gray. So it's actually a brain function to distract so that you can take care of business. You know, it's the same thing that allows you to run out of a burning building with a broken ankle, you know, or make a touchdown, you know, and then you deal with the pain. Mm. So we are capable of distraction. There are some pains that just can't be distracted from. So the harder we try to distract, and why doesn't it go away, and this has got to stop, is the opposite. You know, and it generates more anxiety and angst and fear and frustration. So,
which the theory then would be to remove triggers,
if you can.
If you can. But for example, if you're feeling, I don't know, going through a divorce,
sure,
and you're heartbroken over a divorce, it may be that somebody really needs to change their lifestyle, perhaps, or move out of the house they're in, or. Mm-hmm.
If it's doable,
right.
I mean, that makes great sense. There's a Buddhist saying that if you walk on the earth and it's covered with rocks, so you cut your feet and you hurt your feet, the solution was to cover the earth with leather. And then somebody came along and said, why don't you just put leather on your feet?
Right.
Because it's your body that's feeling the pain. So, you know, you can't. I mean, if you can get a person out of your house that you broke up with, by all means, those are the practical nuts and bolts stuff, but the feelings is what you're talking about. And
yeah, because the pain is what creates for a lot of people revenge. The pain is what creates gossip. The pain, like, if it didn't, like a lot of things that negatively impact perhaps someone else or yourself, is all
clearly yourself, you know,
is from pain often
in an attempt to get out of pain,
right? Yeah.
But it's a futile attempt,
but it never works.
No,
because from all your experience, the, like the five steps you mentioned, that's like the best practice.
I think that it is. Yeah. And it, and they've got data. There was a study in actually the Journal of American Medical Association that studied 150 people with back pain, 50 of them got this treatment and they had like 80% reduction in their pain, and 55% of them had the same pain relief at a year.
Wow.
And their brains changed. So,
but how does someone do this who's listening, who lives in, you know, Milwaukee?
I mean, if they can't afford to come to the point, most people can.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's a luxury high end.
There's a book actually. I mean, I have a book called The Pain Antidote. It describes a lot of what we're talking about. The newest book is Alan Gordon's The Way Out. And it describes in explicit detail this treatment modality. And then they do virtual treatment. They can work with people in other states,
but they can't do therapy across state lines. They can't
if they have a license. You know, it's
if they're licensed in that state or whatever. So someone could get the benefit of that.
They could, or they could investigate.
I'm not totally anti-online.
I know. I mean, if you're in Milwaukee,
if it serves a purpose, yes.
Yeah, and
I'm talking about someone that's like around the corner.
I know. And staying in their pajamas. Yeah, I totally get that.
Yeah, but that's really interesting that physical pain that. The majority of it really comes down to emotional pain because it's in the same part of the brain.
Correct.
And that a lot of people will spend time, perhaps, that it could be needed to go to physical therapy or...
You know, there's no harm. Certainly moving your body is really important, and moving it with a skilled observer, you know, trained person is a really good idea. So it's a trainer or a physical therapist or a chiropractor. But to think that that's going to be the solution is unrealistic.
Yeah, like I was with a friend over the weekend, and he's young. I mean, he's 30 years old, and he has back pain, like herniated disc, right? And it was interesting because I kept talking to him, and I was like, dude, let's figure out a way to like get you out of pain. Like, what do you there's other in my gut, it just felt like he was looking at it defeated now.
Yeah.
Like really defeated because he felt like he went to physical therapy. Nothing changed.
Yeah.
He doesn't feel any better. It's been 6 months.
Yeah. So that's a chronic pain syndrome. And he, I mean, if I was his friend, I would tell him to look at his thoughts and feelings related to, and really investigate The Way Out, the book. It doesn't, people don't resonate. They want a physical explanation. They want a fix, you know, and people get pissed when I talk to them often, because it's like, you know, you're discounting the what's wrong with me.
Right.
I think, I mean, on a broader scale, I think the whole medical system is messed up because we look for a physical solution and we neglect the fact that thoughts and what about diabetics? What about people with heart disease? What about people with, you know, and then there's these pain conditions we see at the point, irritable bowel syndrome, interstitial cystitis, chronic headaches, you know, conditions that are debilitating. And I've had patients that I've treated, and within a short period of time, they get the message, they believe it because they want to get well, and they start doing the work, and their pain is virtually gone. Virtually gone.
How much training do doctors have in addiction?
Oh, in addiction?
Terrible. Like how many weeks or what's typical?
Weeks?
There's hours. Not even weeks, huh?
Hours.
That's it?
Now, there was a study, it's quite a number of years old, so I don't know what we would say today in medical schools, but I can tell you that it was like an average of 2 hours over the course of a four-year curriculum.
Really?
And when we bring them, because I'm part of the addiction medical establishment, if you will, and when we bring recommendations to include that in medical schools, the medical school response is typically, we have so many things that we have to cover, you know. We just don't have any more time. They get it in psychiatry. Well, no, you really don't. It's not like most psychiatrists.
That's what I've always thought that a bit odd that like a primary care physician, I heard this, I don't know if it's still true, but they were the largest prescriber of antidepressants. That's what I heard.
That's probably true.
But it's kind of interesting because if you didn't study the brain, it kind of puts people in a hero role, but they're not like, it would be like my, I did interventions for years. I all different types of interventions, and it would be, there's so many things that are out of my scope.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose that's really just what our hope is with
docs. Yeah. Less so, you know, I mean, to get a medical degree, you can do neurosurgery. I mean, you don't have to know how.
Really?
Yeah. You probably wouldn't get privileges at a hospital to do it.
Right.
But with a medical license, you can do whatever you want.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm a family doc. So in my medical practice, I prescribed antidepressants. How much did I know about the brain and how much did I know about antidepressants and how they worked? Not that much.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think I did an okay job. See, I don't think medication for depression is the answer either. Mm-hmm. It may be adjunctive, but you got to connect with the patient. You got to, I mean, people who are depressed have to change,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they have to be helped to change, directed, the same as the kind of folks we're talking about or with addiction. So to think that a pill is going to fix mm-hmm. a dysfunction in 50 billion brain cells with thousands of chemicals and trillions of connections is absurd.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Mel Pohl, where can everyone find you? Like, what's the best way to is?
I work at The Point in Malibu. Pointmalibu.com is our website. I actually have a website too. It's pretty puny, but it's drmelpohl.com.
P-O-H-L. Okay.
My email is mpohl@thepointmalibu.com.
Got it.
Yeah.
Well, thanks, Mel, for coming on Always Evolving and connecting with me. And
for connecting with me. That's
I think it's a great resource. I think this is an under-talked about subject matter that affects millions
and
of people.
And misunderstood. You know, super, I mean, that's my interest is in straightening it out. And, you know, I get kind of cross-eyed looks when I start talking about it, but people get it, you know, just kind of like you were able to identify and relate. I mean, it is true, you know, it is true that the majority of the experience of pain is living in our brain and we can modify that. Can't do much about a crushed disc.
Yeah.
You can do a whole lot about your fear and your anxiety and your anger.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Dr. Mel.
My pleasure.
And everyone, make sure you click to subscribe, rate this podcast episode, shoot me a DM on Instagram @CoachMikeBear. Let me know what you thought. Until next time, keep it magical.